Hi, I'm Andrew Rich, and if you're like me, you look at the state of modern wrestling discourse and think, wow, what a cesspool. That's why I'm here to tell you about Music of the Mat Remix. That's right, your favorite wrestling music podcast is back with a new format, where I bring on a guest and we play songs related to wrestling-themed topics. It could be a wrestling reference, a wrestling concept, a wrestling pun, things of that nature. Now you might be saying, Andrew, that is a very, very tenuous connection to pro wrestling on a wrestling podcast network. Is this just an excuse to hang out with your friends and talk about music and ignore the rest of the wrestling landscape? Yes. Yes, it is. So listen to Music of the Mat Remix on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network, available on Apple, Spotify, or your podcast player of choice.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Welcome back to another episode of The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcasting Network. I'm your host, Tyler Fornes. With me, as always, is Fred Moreland, who is trying new technology for the first time today. How are you?
Yes, I hear it's called a telephone.
A telephone. It's a wonderful piece of technology. Yes. It's been around for 150 years. Yes. Hey, you know what? One day, you're going to be able to get AOL online or Net Zero or Juno. It's going to be a wonderful thing.
One of these days, I'll get my hands on one of those CDs. It'll help a lot. Let's talk about the most important thing in the world of wrestling, Tyler. College football playoff.
So hell yeah.
We got our new rankings out this week. You know, we're headed into conference championship. By the time people may be listening to this, they may actually be able to watch the American championship game between Army and Tulane.
God bless.
That is happening on Friday night, let alone all the Saturdays.
Fred, there's three games on Friday night.
Oh, there are. What are the other ones?
The Mountain West title game, Boise State and UNLV.
Oh, that'll be
and
good.
I believe the Sun Belt title game, Marshall and Louisiana.
That is the funniest one of the entire weekend because Marshall and their head coach hate each other very much. So
he's rumored to take the Southern Miss job right now, which is very interesting.
Because he hates Marshall. Marshall.
I apologize.
I don't like him either.
Marshall, Louisiana is Saturday night. Tonight, Western Kentucky and Jacksonville State.
No, the least essential one. But, you know,
No. This might be the best game of the weekend.
Oh, it might be a fun game. Just, you know, if your eyes on the prize in it, it doesn't matter at all.
Dog, tickets as low as $5. Hell yeah.
Where are they playing that at? Maybe I need to remake my plans tonight.
Right on the panhandle in Jacksonville, Alabama.
Nope, never mind. All right, so what do you think about the playoff rankings?
You thought they were going to be in Bowling Green, Kentucky, didn't you?
They could have. They could have.
If Western Kentucky had a better conference record, they would be.
Yeah, that's their own damn fault.
So the playoff rankings, I think, on an overall scope, I think they're doing okay, but it's evident that the people in charge are just continuing to apply logic for one set of teams and then using completely different logic for other sets of teams. And to me, that's the most frustrating part. I want consistency. I want them to articulate that consistency, and I want them to at least having had watched the games, because it's a bunch of like college football administrators. They don't watch all these games. Like, get me and nine buddies who are just degenerates and watch everything. Let's get us in a room and let's talk about it. And then let's figure it out.
Fortunately, the coaches poll is there to take care of that issue, because everyone definitely watches all those games. So our top 12 right now are Oregon, Texas, Penn State, Notre Dame, Georgia, Ohio State, Tennessee, SMU, Indiana, Boise State, Alabama and Miami. They take the top 12, but they don't take the top 12 ranked teams because they are guaranteed to take in five conference champions, and the Big 12 conference champ would be the 12th team, one assumes, at this point in time, barring a Boise State loss. So that would be either Arizona State or Iowa State, who are 15th and 16th, and they have been bitching about the fact that, oh no, they might be ranked behind a one-loss Boise State team. A blue. I think this is about as good of a top 12 as you can reasonably have. I think this is actually a year where, you know how sometimes in the NFL playoffs you'll get like a 8-8 team or a 7-9 team as the bottom seed in one conference, that kind of thing, because they won their shitty division. That's kind of what's going on here to me with the last at-large bid that Alabama appears to almost have locked in, barring a Clemson ACC win, more or less, I think. Because one assumes that SMU will get in regardless of that second loss, or maybe Miami over them, I guess. Or no, actually, in that case, it would just be Clemson from the ACC, I believe, if I'm doing my mind bracket correctly. I'm not really bothered by this, mainly because I think you got a good top 10. And then after that, it's kind of like, well, you got a cluster of teams, and I don't have strong feelings on who like 11 and 12 in the ranking should be. And it, right now it's Alabama and Miami, because Miami just choked away what should have been a good seed and a solid placement because they lost to Syracuse. Now we got to argue about if a three-loss SEC team is better than a two-loss Miami team, and which of the three three-loss SEC teams that are in position are better. And it's just like, okay, I guess Bama will go in. Why not?
Here's my big thing. In college football, wins have always mattered. And to boil it down the way this committee has, by essentially saying, hey, Miami is worse than three-loss Alabama, who Miami lost to Georgia Tech by one score, who took Georgia to eight overtimes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then they lost to Syracuse, won nine games, who beat UNLV on the road, who has been very competitive across their entire schedule, who's got a great offense. Alabama lost at Vanderbilt.
I'd say Vanderbilt and Georgia Tech are roughly equivalent, I'd say.
Sure. But they also got boat raced by Oklahoma, who's terrible.
They did, but their other loss was to Tennessee, who are ranked seventh.
Sure, but are we talking about what's more important, winning football games or losing to good teams? That's kind of the discussion we're having, and quite frankly, Bama's got three losses. They don't deserve to be in it over Miami. They just don't.
I don't know. I mean, Alabama has wins against Georgia, against Missouri, who is very good and highly ranked.
No, they're not. Missouri sucks. Missouri is not a good football team.
They are 19th in the rankings, so that's going to be a difficult...
That is also something that I have contention with. Miami is not the 19th... Or sorry, Missouri... It's not the 19th best team in the country. I have a big problem with that.
Okay. Well, regardless, they are considered that. They also beat LSU at LSU. LSU, I am not seeing them in the rankings. I'm sure everything's fine there. Brian Kelly's just doing okay. Don't worry about it.
They were 7-5 and bad.
Miami's, like, what is Miami's best win? Because I'm looking at it right now, and... Is it at Louisville?
At Louisville. At Florida.
Florida was really bad at the start of the year, though.
Sure, but they're 7-5.
Yeah, but like that was not 7-5 Florida right there. That was looking to be like 4-8 Florida until they changed their quarterback and a few other things. Yeah, I don't think Miami can really put that pelt on the wall, you know? So my argument is basically there's not a right answer for this last spot between Alabama or Miami, or if you prefer South Carolina or Ole Miss. They all kind of stink, and you got to put one of them in. And I don't think I'm going to get mad about whoever gets in. It's going to be like, all right, whatever. Someone's got to take the spot.
I'm gonna be mad about a 3-loss team who got in over a 2-loss team that narrowly missed their conference championship game. For me, you can look at kind of some of the nuanced details. One thing that I like to look at is, if you can, is common opponents. They have one common opponent this year, and that was South Florida. Alabama at home barely got past South Florida.
By 26 points. That's not barely. Oh, that's that's Alabama. Yeah. Alabama 42, South Florida 16.
Yeah, but
Alabama scored 28 in the fourth quarter.
That's the only reason why they were down in the second half.
Who cares?
They played four quarters. Yeah, but they struggled with them. Miami won what? 55-10?
50-15, it looks like.
Yeah, they bolt raced the hell out of them. That game wasn't close. And I understand that style points matter. But beating South Florida by 26 when you were losing in the second half doesn't exactly scream that this was a good win. And one of the things with the original College Football Playoff Committee, why Florida State was left out last year, is they had it written like in the bylaws or in their mission statement or however they framed it, was they wanted to get the best teams. I'm sorry, I can't buy Bama as being this significantly better team than Miami. I actually think Miami beats them on a neutral field. And I hate using that hypothetical because these hypothetical matchups are the people have talked about is just bullshit. It's just a way to get SEC teams in. But winning games matters. Miami did more of it on their schedule and intentionally tried to play better non-conference opponents, and I think that should be rewarded.
Wait, we're saying Miami played better non-conf? Is that your argument here?
They made a significant effort to play a better non-conf, yes.
I'm not. I mean, if we're going to give them credit for playing Florida in 2024 at the start of the year, I mean, I just feel like we kind of spit the bit here. My whole argument just boils down to, like, you could argue either way. I just don't think there's, like, a right answer. You know, I could probably go to, you know, SP Plus from Bill Connolly and see, like, whichever team is rated higher. It's just my entire argument is, like, I don't know, who cares? Yeah, they're roughly equivalent. It's more or less a coin flip. I think boiling it down to one team has 2 losses, one team has 3, and treating the schedule as, you know, blindly equivalent is, you know, wrongheaded. I just don't think there's a right answer here, but you got to put one in, and I just can't get invested. This isn't like Florida State had a great year, lost their QB at the end of the year, and now we're going to boot them out. You know, like, that was an actual bad decision. This is just like, well, they got to put someone in, and, you know, it's going to lead to unhappiness, whatever, but it's all because teams couldn't take care of business on the field.
I think there's a part of that I agree with, but you're also saying that a Power 5 team that won more games should miss out on the playoff because an SEC team lost one more. And I don't want to have that precedent set. It's a bunch of bogus baloney. Like, SMU's in danger of missing the playoff if they lose, and SMU is 11-1, and their only loss is to BYU.
And then it would be to Clemson.
They bolt raced good opponents. 9-3 Duke. They had to narrowly win out that one. Duke's 9-3. They're a good football team. Like, I don't want to reward 9-3 Bama. They have a bad loss. They have an okay loss to Vanderbilt. I can't do it. If you put any other name on Alabama's resume, any other name, that team's not getting in.
I think that they're basically equivalent with Miami or Ole Miss or South Carolina.
Oh, I have thoughts on Ole Miss. Ole Miss should not be in the playoff. Ole Miss.
I mean, sure. But they don't have a mechanism to be like, none of you, you must be this tall to ride this ride, which I think would be the real answer, which is we have a fifth bye now. Congrats, Notre Dame. or Penn State or whoever would fall into that spot. I don't know. I think like getting heated about which team is, the last at large team in this batch is just kind of whatever. You know, they're the same. They're essentially the same, and you can get mad about the SEC harder, or you can get mad about two loss versus three loss. I mean, like, I don't know. Maybe don't lose two or three games.
Yeah, I get it.
Anyway,
I can't believe I'm defending Miami. I hate Miami.
But look,
here we are.
This is another one where my who cares stance is correct because of the. I mean, it's Alabama versus Miami, and you got to take a side. I don't have to. I'm going to sit this one out, brother. All right, let's talk about what we're here. All Elite Wrestling, a promotion. It's fine. It's totally fine. Don't worry about it. TV ratings are awful. Okay, so first of all, last week, November 27th, Thanksgiving Eve, that Dynamite had 536,000 viewers, 0.15 in the 18 to 49, and 0.07 in the 18 to 34. That is the lowest 18 to 49 and 18 to 34s ever. Part of the issue, I think you can point to it a little bit, but I think this is also like, you know, diagnosing a paper cut while your patient's, you know, heart has exploded. It aired at 5 p.m. on the West Coast. It wasn't announced ahead of time as such on TV. I guess it wasn't figured out until 2 days before, which is just fine. Nothing wrong there. So, you know, a bit of a mess there. You know, they lost some West Coast viewership, I'm sure, but I don't know that it would have really mattered that much. I don't know that they're hitting 600,000 because of that. You go on to Saturday. Now, Saturday, they did have a weird schedule. They had a Collision airing at 4 to 6 p.m., and then Rampage was 6 to 7 p.m., and I believe directly against the Survivor Series show WWE was running at that time. Collision had 144,000 viewers with a 0.03 in 18 to 49, and Rampage had 126,000 with a 0.03. I'm doing that because it was a Lucha Libre show in 18 to 49. You know, I don't think that there's much value in really digging deep into especially the Saturday ratings. I think that the Wednesday one was concerning because they had previously had much better ratings on Thanksgiving Eves in the past. So the fact that they dropped down to that was auspicious, but again, I've said this before on the show, and I always will, I would never draw a conclusion off a single number regarding a promotion or a single week's numbers. So let's go to December the 4th, 2 days ago. As we record that, Dynamite came back. It was not a holiday. There was no NBA that night. Should be able to bounce back. Nope, 586,000, 0.17 in the 18 to 49. That was number 11 for the day, number 4 in the time slot. That's an ugly number. I think if you go and you look at historical ratings for the past few months in AEW, all their lowest ratings have been in the past, I think, 6 months. If I recall the Brandon Thurston tweet or post, I forget if it was on Blue Sky or not. This promotion is incredibly cold right now. In fact, as I'm just going to go over this, I'm just going to scroll through the history of the ratings for AEW Dynamite exclusively. I'm not looking at Collision. So we you know, you're back in 2019 to early 2020. You're in the 800s to 900s. Then in late 2020, it's more 7s and 8s, but you know, early 20, you know, you get back to like the 8s and 9s by the end of that year. 2021 starts off a little slower, 700,000 to 800,000, and then you get a few millions, actually a good stretch of millions through September, and their hottest period ever. And that carries over in early 2022. And then you get into mid 2022, you got eights and nines, mainly nines, very respectable numbers. And then through the rest of 2022, it's mainly nines and millions. And then, 2023 is more eights and nines, which again, good. And then in early 2024, seven and eights. And that's when I think you should start to get concerned, you know. Granted, there's, you have the loss of TV viewers and all that, but, And then summer this year, 600s, 700s continuing to drop. And now it's really looking, Tyler, like we may be living in the high 500s to 600s range. And that is concerning. I think AEW has been cold this year pretty terribly, and it has not improved. They really, and I think the weirdest part is I've never felt like they've really reacted to that. Now, I would say it would be bad if they panicked, if they outright were like, well, we got to change something, and they just started throwing everything at the wall. They started changing plans on a week-to-week basis. I would not want that. That would be bad. But I think it's arguably even more concerning, or at least a different kind of concerning, I should say, that in the 2024 reaction has been we're just going to keep going. And you've got all these storylines that feel really cold. Like you've got MJF Adam Cole, which feels frigid. No heat, and it's still going. You've got, I think Mercedes Moné's storylines this year have largely been bleh, very weak. I think Mariah May and the Toni Storm stuff has gotten worse as time went on, especially when Toni Storm went away. I think, like, and that's not to say that it was, Stone Cold coming through the curtain when Toni Storm was around, but I think it's just gotten more dire when it's just been Mariah May, cocky heel champion, without any real, like, just with a challenger of the month. I think going from one kind of generic evil heel unit in the elite at the top of the company, threatening the company and all that, to kind of just different presentation of that heel group with the BCC or the Death Riders, I guess. I think that has not worked. I remember we did the show right after the big Moxley, angle with Danielson, and I was very excited because it felt like that they were going to present them as a di very different kind of group, and that's not what we got. We just got kind of, like it very quickly just became, oh, they're heels. And like, I think it's great guys in that group. Let's not kid ourselves, but it doesn't have any juice. And I don't know, man. Like this just feels like a very aimless promotion right now. I don't think anything is particularly over with the crowd. I think Swerve Strickland is over. I think it's a company that's short on stars at this point in time. And I think you can probably count on one hand the number of people that are genuinely coming across as stars in reactions to them. And I think it's like Will Ospreay and Swerve Strickland, neither of whom are in the top company, in the top storyline right now. And I don't know, with maybe that's overly harsh. Willow Nightingale has kind of, I mean, she's going to be in this tournament they're doing right now for the January 5th show in New Japan. But boy, it's just kind of dire, and I feel like they finally have made changes to how they're planning buildings, and I understand that that's kind of, been a slow moving thing, and I understand why that would be the case. But this is something that I would have expected them to start addressing a few months ago, that they were like, oh, that they should have been in March or April, been like, oh, we're in a bad situation. We have no buy-in from our fans, and we got to make this look better on TV. And they haven't, you know, until just now, until it looks like they were, you know, like with the Fishers building that came across better on TV. And I don't know, man, it's just kind of, I don't know what they're doing. I feel like it's very weird. And it's, I think more than anything, it is a creative issue. And, you know, we've talked in the past about how sometimes the storylines in AEW have been too WWE-fied for our tastes. And I think you could argue that's like a factor. I think that really killed the MJF Adam Cole storyline, but you know, I don't think that's the sole reason. You know, I think pointing at, you know, being like, oh, they had Jimmy Jacobs and he ruined them and all that stuff. You know, they're doing this this thing on July 12th for all in Texas. They decided to leave Wembley and come to the U.S. to do All In. They're going to hold it in Globe Life Field in Arlington, Texas. That's the ballpark of the Texas Rangers. It seats 40,300 is the listed Wikipedia seating capacity. You go to the Observer this week. They did the pre-sale this past week for that show, which I didn't even know, which is a problem. Would you like to guess, if you don't know, Tyler, and if you do, then, you know, the game's ruined, but would you like to guess how many tickets they sold according to the range that Dave Meltzer got?
For which show are we talking?
We're talking next year's All In Texas, July 12th.
Isn't it, what, like $3,000? Or 3,000 tickets, I mean?
Yeah, it was $2,000 to $3,000 for their pre-sale for their big, like, supposedly their biggest show each year. That is an atrocious number. I think that they better be looking for a backup arena to put the show in after that number. I don't know. Like, AEW is just extremely cold right now. Like, we're talking a, like, it feels like we're talking, you know, low on the Kelvin scale towards absolute zero right now. And I don't know what they're going to be able to do to turn it around, but the vibes on this promotion are terrible right now. The Continental Classic has not felt hot. It's not like that part has felt bad or anything, but, you know, they haven't had a great match yet. I mean, maybe a low-level great match, but not like a show-of-the-year level match, I guess is how I would probably best put it. And given that, like, you know, I think across the show, it's kind of a big, big issue that they're just not able, that they have not been able to address, and I feel like they've been too passive on addressing it. And, you know, as I think Odie in the background snores like hell as I try to gather a thought there. Yeah, it's, I don't know, man. Like, I'm not saying this, actually the Continental Classic is really bad or anything. Like, that's obviously not what I'm saying, but it feels like they just got a bunch of not over people in this tournament. And, you know, I think part of their rating problem was that they main evented Brody King and Claudio Castagnoli. And I like both those guys a lot. I think they're fantastic wrestlers. I think they're among the best on the planet. Brody disappears too much for me to... Yeah, I'm working on my FSM 50 ballot. I've got Claudio in the top 10. And if Brody was around more, I feel like he'd be a safe pick for the top 50. And maybe by tournament's end, he'll sneak in there just because if he has a great tournament. But I don't think that they're, like, massively over. And I think what's really concerning is that they've really... Everyone that's been on TV this year, I feel like almost exclusively, There's a couple exceptions. I'd point to like Swerve, Willow Nightingale, maybe Will Ospreay. And that might be the list that are they are everyone else, I think, is less over now than they were at the start of the year. And that's brutal, man. That is truly rough. And I don't, you know, it's at this point, you know, I've had this concern before, and I may have said it on the show before. I can't recall. We've been doing this so long, and I'm such an idiot that I can't remember, you know, the whole Tony Khan does three high-level executive jobs, you know, thing has always felt like a fraught situation, you know, where he is going to have to choose, you know, one thing or another. And do you want to be the stat guy for the Jaguars and the Fulham Club, or do you want to be the guy who runs a wrestling company and leads creative? Because I can't imagine having the hours on in a week to do both well. And I don't think either Jaguar or Fulham fans are particularly happy with the on-field performance from those teams. You know, we're getting a little afield here, but I don't know, man. Like, they got a massive issue and they're going to have to fix it, is really what it comes down to. And we'll see if they crack the code on doing that. It's not going to be an overnight thing. I think, you know, the thing I was thinking the closest to was, you know, when they kind of WWF in the mid-90s went from like the really dire part of the new generation era to the not the attitude era, because that's obviously not like that's a thing that you hope happens. You can never really count on that happening. But to the at least more solid era where it was like you had Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, and Undertaker on top. And not that they were drawing gangbusters, but they are at least improved from like the direst of like 1993, you know? So I don't know. AEW is in a really tough position right now. I think a lot of fans have lost the drive to be super invested in this company for a variety of reasons. And I think that it's going to be really hard for them to reestablish that. I have to say personally, and mind you, October and November are very busy months for my company, but I think that I've only watched like maybe one live Dynamite in that entire time, and everything else has been DVR. And part of it is my schedule, but part is also like, if I wanted to watch it, I'd be watching it, right? And instead, I'm just like, well, I'll watch the C2 matches on Thursday, you know? Well, I've watched all of Dynamite, but you know, like there wasn't anything putting my ass in a seat. And if, you know, I've been watching this promotion since day one, I wrote Dynamite reviews for the site for I think over a year. We've been doing this podcast for over 2 years now, right? If I'm like, you know, I'll get to it, that's probably not good.
Oh, I finally get to talk.
Sure, yeah.
I
This
didn't
has been a
realize I was on the
diatribe.
podcast anymore.
Hey, look, I had shit to say, buddy.
Hey, listen, I get. So you kind of laid out a lot of stuff there.
I did.
And I'm not even going to try and hash out what you said because you have a lot. And I think what we're kind of starting to see, and something that was starting to trend last year or even before, and I think this plays into about 10% of or AEW's ratings issues. Less people are watching television. They just are. I don't think you can place this decline in viewership solely on that.
You
But I
can't.
do think you can place a small amount of the declining viewership on the fact that less people are just watching television. They are watching
I would
the
agree with that to an extent, but it's also like I said, that's a paper cut and not the cancer or not the heart attack.
and that's why I feel like 10% is it feels like a fairish number. It's low, it's small, but it's still somewhat significant. The other thing is, even if less people are watching television, I cover the world in the NFL full time. If your product's good, people will watch, and it doesn't matter how few people are watching television. NFL ratings are up.
Exactly.
And people are seeking out games on streaming platforms when they have them. Christmas Day is going to have two games on Netflix. There's a playoff game solely on Peacock. Amazon has Thursday night games. And the only time that they're shown on broadcast television are when they're in the local market. So, like, last night, Green Bay Packers took on the Detroit Lions. Michigan and Wisconsin got those games on local television. That's been a regular thing for cable primetime games for a long time. Monday Night Football, and before then, Sunday Night Football, when it was on ESPN, that you would have a local network airing a simulcast. Same with whenever games are on NFL Network. So, but people are trying to find these games. They want to watch them. And I think that is such a big part of this. If your product is really, really good, people would be flocking and flocking and flocking to watch. They would be flocking to buy tickets. And pay-per-view tickets have stayed steady. Pay-per-view buys have not crashed. I don't think we have gotten a number yet for WrestleDream or Full Gear.
I'm very interested to see those because that could be the other canary in the coal mine. But anyways, I digress.
All these are interesting factors here, Fred. And I'm really, really frustrated on an overall scale. And the tough part is when we're having these conversations, when we're having this discussion, it kind of boils down to the same thing. Stupid people on Twitter have ruined this company. And I think we kind of should have seen it coming from an early on level. Because Tony Khan is the most online promoter of all time. He grew up on the message boards. He grew up like being a pro wrestling junkie. He grew up on the Observer board. He's a poster. He is a professional internet troll to an extent. And I don't necessarily mean that as a derogatory thing, because a lot of times trolls are derogatory, but when something happens and he can get a dig in at somebody, he's going to do it. He's going to throw it up on Twitter. Mm-hmm. He's going to dig at you. And that in itself is part of the big cause, because not only is he trying to get digs at other people, throw digs at WWE, throw digs at Bischoff, which, let's be real, in real time, we loved. It was great. It was telling these people to shut up. But then he started listening to the bad faith WWE accounts making fun of, honestly, a lot of the good things that AEW is doing that was different, and then continuing to call it minor league. And you can brush that off for a long time, but eventually, I don't think this is necessarily the right term for it, but like the term Stockholm syndrome is you start to become like infatuated with your captors, and you kind of start to like assimilate with them and become friendly. And then it just becomes such a normal that all of a sudden you're not necessarily worried about escaping. You just kind of accepted things. And I think some of that construct has kind of happened to Tony Khan, where he has listened to all these people badmouth AEW, badmouth the great things that they were doing, the storylines, the fact that they weren't telling stories when they tell way more stories than the other companies, the fact that like they're just a flippy do company, and all these detractions. You've heard them all before, you'll hear them all again. And eventually, those things just started to seep into his brain, and he started hiring people that enabled those elements. And now you have what AEW is now, a pro wrestling company that delivers some really good storylines, some that are absolute crap, and the matches aren't enough to carry this thing anymore. And they've run off the real core fan base that built this company. The ones that would want to travel to every quarterly pay-per-view, the ones that would tune into Dynamite, because for about, what, the first 6 months until the pandemic hit, it was the hottest thing in wrestling. Watching a Wednesday television show was the hottest thing in pro wrestling. It was great. You never knew what was going to happen. Stuff was happening every single week. They were getting these fiery storylines over. They were getting all these new characters introduced to the audience. The rise and fall of Orange Cassidy should be studied at some point. because of what they ended up doing with him was just sheer brilliance, and then they absolutely destroyed it. He succumbed to the bad faith grifters on social media. He succumbed to people talking so negatively about his product that he eventually changed it to the things they wanted. But here's the thing. Those people weren't going to watch anyways. The people that are watching will have criticisms, and we have throughout the entirety of this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I think the best AEW analysis outside of us has really come from the flagship, where it's been even keel. It's been honest. And they've been right way more than anybody else. But there's been real criticisms throughout the course of time. Who's got the title? How the title storyline's been playing out? How guys have been built? And how Tony Khan's method of pushing people is getting people in like 50-50 matches, just having them lose until you're ready to pull the trigger. Like, that's been a point of contention. Now, has it worked? We can have that debate. I don't think it's worked as well as you would like it to. But that's because you're having them lose so frequently. It's okay to lose if you're not being pushed. That's part of pro wrestling. But you gotta be better about how you expose some of these people. And I think that's one of the problems right now with where Takeshita is at. It's the poor usage across the board, both not being on television and the fact that he lost so much in the come-up. It's honestly, I'd say 90% of the issues in this company can really be derived from Tony Khan listening to the bad faith grifters and trolls on social media and adhering to what their vision of pro wrestling is and then trying to justify it and how he frames things, because that led to him hiring people who are writers, hiring people like Jimmy Jacobs, who we blame for a lot of this crap. I honestly think it can boil down to Tony Khan just not being able to tune out the bad noise and listen to the good noise. And it's
do think that's a factor. That's definitely a strong factor. I think it's a multifactorial kind of creative issue. And that is a part of that is that, he tried to appeal to people that weren't in his core audience and ended up not drawing them in and also hurting his own core audience. So I think that all hurt him meaningfully. I think another thing is, you lose stars like Kenny Omega's out and all that. We can point to that, but I mean, the stars that were around just like this year, the Young Bucks, I think they had a pretty good in-ring year, and Kazuchika Okada had a pretty good in-ring year, but I think people are disappointed in both because they didn't work as much as you would like to see. And also their gimmicks were bad. Their character work was lacking. And they often disappeared for long stretches of time. And I'll tell you, I liked the Okada Garcia match in on Collision in the C2. I didn't love it. I thought it was like a 4-star match around there. It wasn't exactly Okada walking into the Tokyo Dome, right? So they made him feel not special. Maybe you can point to his performances as well. It's funny, I think Okada has had a year that is like top 40-ish in the world. It's not a matter of ability, it's a matter of output. And my point that I'm getting to here is the way I hear people talk about him is like he's completely washed, and I don't think he is, but I can't blame him for thinking that because, before in New Japan, he was consistently one of the best wrestlers in the world. And this year, if you're saying that, you're insane, So it's just a very difficult and frustrating situation, and I think it's going to be a long, long road to get out of it, and they're going to need a good creative idea. They're going to need a good act getting hot. And I don't see anything at the horizon right now. I mean, I think Omega's return would be nice, but I don't think it's going to spark some kind of hot period. This Death Riders thing, maybe it'll get over to the way they want, but right now it feels like it's very much kind of just caught as a not super over heel group. And
that's where we are, you know, and it's just going to be like that until it's not, and I don't know what's going to make it not.
The tough part is it's easier to build from nothing than it is to rebuild what's already burned down.
Yes.
That's a very good point.
When I moved into my house, this was a brand new house, and it took them about 7-8 months to build it. Okay. And now part of that is due to the fact that it was built during the pandemic, and there were like a lot of supply issues and all that stuff. I had two of my really close friends, their house burned down a few years back. It took them almost 18 months to rebuild.
Mm-hmm.
It takes significantly longer because you have to completely clean up what was destroyed and then have the faith be built back up to a point where you can, you know, have it completed. The problem is you pissed off so many of the core fan base, it's going to take a lot to bring them back. It's going to take a lot for them to watch live. Like, just we can, like, part of the pulse of AEW was the hottest 2 hours in our office Slack every single week was Wednesday from 7 to 9 Central. Mm-hmm. The entire Slack would be watching Dynamite,
talking about it, having fun.
Yeah,
but ain't no more.
This week, I think the first there were like 4 or 5 messages, from 7 to 8 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna pull this up because it was dead as dead.
And one of those messages was me looking in at like 25 minutes in or whatever, and saying, "Man, no one's talking about the show, huh?" So, real good.
Yeah, it's rough, man. Part of it is like when you go into our office Slack. We're all wrestling fans. We love this stuff. There's a reason why we do a podcast on this stuff. Like,
I mean, for those that don't go into the Slack, or I'm sorry, the Discord, and look at our show channel, I keep a running tally of my Wrestler of the Year thing and update it every week because I'm that big of a dork about it. I'm trying to watch 1,000 matches this year. I'm at 900 now.
Damn.
As we talk, I am currently watching a All Japan match from April, so I can get that down on the spreadsheet because I want to see how Ryuki Honda and Yuma Enzai do here in this Champions Carnival match that I think most people have forgotten about.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty good. I think it might be better than anything in the C2 so far. Yeah, that's a 4.25 match. But like just to, you know, just kind of pop off my, you know, my rating so far. Like, I think the best match we've had in the past couple weeks has been actually Ishii and Jericho. I thought that was a 4.25 star match. But I mean, you know, I'm pointing out a little bit of an issue here, which is the C2 is supposed to be like really great matches. And we have a couple 4-stars, Claudio and Ricochet, Garcia Okada, and Brody and Claudio for me. But, you know, it's been a while since even on TV that AEW's really had like a great, you know, TV match. Like the last time I gave anything 4.5 stars was October. You know, and I mean, granted, that's only been a few weeks, but to go all of November without a match that I thought was 4.5 or better on TV is kind of wild for AEW. It's definitely not at the in-ring level that, you know, it was like even a year ago. So, you know, if that's a key part of your identity and you're not hitting it, that's not going to help things either. But yeah, I mean, the point I think that, you know, you're really trying to make is that, you know, we are a group that loves good pro wrestling, and this hasn't been great Hasn't been a great year for AEW. There's been some really strong matches and some pretty good storylines, but it is struggling as a promotion, and it's very frustrating if you're a fan of AEW.
We just want AEW to be great again. Mm-hmm. We want AEW to be what it was when it started, a promotion that really, really believed in the people, really believed in being different. Not being different to be different, being different because it was right. Being different because it was what people. Yeah, because it was what people wanted.
Yeah.
The hardcores are gone.
I mean, I would say that you're just down to the hardcores at this point. You know?
Sorry. Let me reframe that. The hardcores that were here from the beginning, a lot of them are gone. The initial people that you drew are gone. And it's disappointing. Like, and one of the things with like kind of trying to read the pulse of this company, and a lot of it kind of boils back to what we see just with Voices of Wrestling, because there's just significantly less interest in the promotion. Mm-hmm. We used to do a traveling show every year where we go to All Out in Chicago, and there would be like 20, 25 of us in a suite. That didn't happen this year. Interest is cratered, and it just sucks, because this roster is tremendous.
Yeah, but so much of it just feels directionless. So but anyway,
how about we talk about another thing that's been a really popular topic of conversation?
I forgot that we were going to have to talk about this.
Let's talk about CM Punk. All right. I'm just going to read off the everything that we got from the Fightful report, okay?
This is from the Observer summary of it.
This is the Observer, okay.
Well, it's really a summary of what's on the Fightful thing, and maybe some stuff that Dave had himself, but...
Well, anyways. Hey, you know what? I much prefer Dave's writing, so this is perfect. Here's the synopsis. Nick Nemeth had complained to AEWHR about CM Punk's treatment of him while he was in the company. While they were both in the company. All right. Nick Nemeth sent a complaint letter to AEW regarding his treatment due to CM Punk. Nemeth tweeted, literally the softest man alive, without naming Punk, but widely assumed to be him. Punk confronted him upon his return from the suspension in June 2023. Nemeth wasn't booked after that until August 12th. When Nemeth arrived at the building, Pac Buck told him travel confusion was the reason for him not to go, but then admitted it was because of Punk. Nemeth claims to have audio recordings from May 12th. Nemeth stated that Punk was an executive producer and manager in AEW. Nemeth was told to go to Dynamite in 8/16 and cut a promo on Punk in front of the crowd, apparently by the dumbest motherfucker to ever have existed.
That's my verbiage.
Okay.
That's good.
Nemeth said he spoke with legal and HR that day, was not satisfied with their response. Moxley pushed for Nemeth to be used. Nemeth revealed that there was an external investigation on what to do with Punk, which recommended that he be fired. Nemeth thinks that he was partially held responsible for having to fire Punk. Nemeth claims he was offered a settlement with 3 years pay if he signed an NDA by AEW Legal's Chris Peck, but that was later pulled. Nemeth also claims that Peck later threatened to sue him if it went to arbitration. Megan Parekh would be antagonistic to him. And I think I got her name right. But this whole thing is just bizarre. Like, AEW needs to have professional PR. They don't. And Odie's snoring just confirms it even more. It's a clown show company.
That I think this all kind of boils down, you know, you hear a lot of talk about how Tony Khan is a what they would call in football players coach. But when it comes down to giving people bad news, I think has largely
really try to avoid that as much as possible. And look, I procrastinate, so I can appreciate this. But, you know, if you're the boss of a company and you're not going to renew someone's contract, or, you know, in this case, allegedly you've had a top talent tell you to not have a bottom of the rung talent show up, be at the workplace with him. It's allegedly, according to Ryan Nemeth, instead of like addressing that in a more direct way, they just very much try to dance around it. And I think that that is another example of just like this really poor organizational aspect to AEW. And it's, you know, it kind of lined up with roughly the time of Brawl Out, where all this really got exposed, and, you know, probably were pre-existing issues before then. But boy, the attitude of like 2020, of like Jake Hager telling don't joke about wanting to go home, everyone's really happy here, you know, that story, to like whatever it is now. I mean, we got so much talent just like hanging out at home. Ricky Starks is saying in interviews no one's calling him for like basically a year, half a year I should say, to like tell him what's going on with his contract, his plan. Penta talks about basically, by the way, he's been removed from the roster page to cut off a news item there. So he is seemingly no longer with AEW, but has been gone for months and months because Tony Khan didn't want to use him because he was on the way out. And, you know, you can discuss the justifiability of that decision or not. I think it's not a problem. But, you know, I think Penta also had an interview where he talked about how no one was telling him anything. And this appears to be an up and down issue with AEW. And, you know, the crazy thing about WWE, you know, which we all knew was a company based entirely around what Vince McMahon wanted on his wrestling show, is you'd hear all these stories about people getting fired and they'd be mad at John Laurinaitis or Jim Ross or whoever was head of talent relations, you know. But then they turn around and say, but Vince loved my stuff. And the fact that this happened over and over is one of the craziest things in the history of wrestling to me, because it, you know, obviously Vince didn't love your stuff because you're out of a job. And it's not like Jim Ross is, you know, overruling Vince on who to hire or keep employed. Tony Khan is seemingly very uncomfortable with being the bad guy. He doesn't like being the bad cop. He's a billionaire. He can solve this pretty easily by hiring a bad cop and just having them be, you know, have them be the guy given the talent the bad news, you know, because you, especially I think with wrestling talent, you do need someone able to be the heavy. And it's, I think we've seen over and over that there's an issue with AEW not having anyone do that. Whether it be making CM Punk and the Young Bucks have a meeting to talk out their issues, or getting like, and you know, assuming that there's not health issues, and I think some of these are help, but like you pointed, the various talent that just have stayed at home for long stretches of time. You know, Andrade did for a while. Miro has for a while. I think there's some health issues going on with Keith Lee. And, you know, it's entirely his right to keep those private if he wants to. But, you know, Ricky Starks is another good one. You know, you got all this. And it's just like,
I think it's a major contributing factor to their issues right now. I don't think it's fair to call it the contributing factor, because that gives creative and stuff like that like a real pass on some issues that I think is largely creative based. But yeah, I think it would really benefit AEW to have someone in that role and to be able to give people hard news sometimes. And because that's part of being employed. And I just, it's very frustrating. And it's another issue, I think, with AEW. But boy, we get to talk about the CM Punk drama in December 2024. Love that.
Oh my gosh, it's so exciting, Fred. I love talking about CM Punk and all the drama that he caused while he was in the company. It's such a joy in my life.
It is good and interesting and unique content.
I think there's something that we can kind of talk about here to kind of put a bow on this whole thing, because we've already gone an hour talking about two topics. The big thing with the CM Punk stuff to me is that we don't know specifically if AEW handled the Nemeth stuff in the right or wrong way, because we're only getting one side of the story. And I always believe there's three sides to every story. Your side, my side, and the truth, because no matter what, you're always going to have a slight bias because of your own perspective. And that's why there's always the three sides. We haven't heard from any other side on this. But I can tell you this, based on how AEW's handled other aspects of PR, they don't get the benefit of the doubt at all. They haven't earned the benefit of the doubt. They've actually becoming negative as far as like how we can take them, because they have done such a poor job across the board in just flat out doing the right thing and having good public relations. Like, it's just very, very poor. And arguably, I think they should fix their public relations issues before they fix their on-screen issues, because if you fix the PR issues, because PR is not just about like HR stuff in the building and handling that, because that's a big part of this as well. The public perception of your company is that you're minor league. And getting all these video boards and stuff isn't going to make you look major league. You know what's going to make you look major league? Having someone like Chris LaGentle, head of PR. That's going to make you feel major league. And until they do something like that, it's just going to be constant. It's just going to keep being a revolving door of bullshit. And it's frustrating, because this company could be so great, and it's just not. Because it's, for lack of a better term, poorly run. And one of the major, you know, counterpoints that, as Alexa goes off, that was very odd. One of the big counterpoints that is, oh, they just signed this huge money deal with Turner. That's great. They're going to profit around $45 million in like bare minimum this next year per Dave Meltzer. That's awesome. But there's more to it than just making money. How sustainable and viable are you going to be when your next contract comes up? What are you going to get for that next television deal? You have to now start proving that you deserve another television deal, and you are off to a very poor start.
Yeah.
Got to fix the PR stuff. You fix the PR stuff, the rest of it will start to trickle, and you'll be able to start fixing everything else. And I can't believe we're having the same fucking conversations in year two of this, or year three now of this podcast, Fred. It sucks.
Yep. Not good.
No, not good at all. But let's go through the news and we'll give a quick update on like the Continental Classic and kind of some on-screen storylines. Juice Robinson, speaking of the Continental Classic, is out due to a broken fibula on a blocked sunset flip. No word on if surgery is necessary or if there are additional injury concerns like torn ligaments. But with bad news came some good news. Do you know what that good news is?
What is it, buddy?
That good news is Commander replaced him.
Yes. I think Commander will be a perfectly good pin eater. I think, I think he's a good worker. I enjoy watching him do his stuff, and I think he'll fit in nicely in the whole AW. What the C2 is and what they're looking for in a worker, which is obviously not a top name because this guy is just going to be probably, he'll probably go 0-4, the rest of the matches. And I think they need, that's perfectly fine. I saw Dave Meltzer be like, well, why wasn't it, a bigger name? And it's like, well, because this guy would be losing. So why would you, why would you want it to be, why would you be putting Swerve Strickland in this spot, right? And, you could have just said, oh, it's a rant. They did Hal for, he was the first alternate. And, I don't know, it's very, very silly when it's, clearly looking for a guy to, take a few pins and look pretty good doing it. Commander's pretty high on that list. But anyways. But yeah, I mean, it sucks for Juice. We don't know how long he'll be out. There's a lot of, was there another injury along with this, maybe to his tibia or to some ligaments? And I just think that it's not a surprise. Yeah, I like Commander. I got distracted for a second, and I'm good at podcasting.
Yeah, it's okay.
It'll be fun to watch him.
Yeah, I think Commander rules, and he's also kind of a good pin eater because he's not really pushed. But yeah. You can have some fun ass matches. Just thinks we're gonna not get Commander versus Will Ospreay. Maybe they'll give it to us because he juiced face Will Ospreay. Awesome. Oh, that would have been sweet. But moving on, because there isn't a whole lot else to talk about there. Penta El Cerro Miedo, removed from AEW's roster page. Rey Fénix had time added due to injury, which sucks. But Tony Khan is well within the right to do so.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough precedent to set. If you're gonna be like, hey, we're gonna add time for injury, and you're gonna get pushed, you're gonna be used. Okay, it's understandable. The contracts are well within the right to do so. WWE's been doing that for a long time. But doing so, considering the other guys do it, just makes you the other guys. You're just a lesser version of the other guys. You don't have a competitive advantage anymore. And it sucks. Like, just let him go. Mm-hmm. You're not doing anything with him. What is he like? No, absolutely no offense to the Lucha Brothers. Are they going to move business in a substantial way that it's going to hurt you?
I think they're just I think Tony Khan is just terribly afraid of being made to look like you're losing out. That they're, and I think that's a major issue here. We talked about it earlier with how I think maybe the best way to put what you were talking about earlier is that he's letting other forces set the perception of the company and not mm-hmm. doing enough to kind of try to control the perception of the company. And I think a big part of this is that, remember when Jade Cargill and Brian Pillman Jr. and Ethan Page jumped? And I feel like it's generous to call the guys on that list jumps. But, they did change companies, and, it was a lot of talk online about how, oh my God, this is such a boon for WWE. AEW fumbled the bag. And, look at what they've done with them. Brian Pillman Jr. is an extreme mid-carder. God bless him. Ethan Page is he's kind of
up in the main event scene at times, but he's also like the most JAG worker to, you know, be around. And Jade Cargill don't wrestle. And it's very, you know, imagine what they would do when they bring in a tag team whose ceiling is like, I guess, main roster Axiom and Nathan Frazier. And I say that as a guy that really likes Axiom and Nathan Frazier. I think they're a great tag team. They're going to be in my top 50 pretty easily. But, you know, they're not driving business. They're not really changing things. I do think it's very funny that AEW is openly trying to court Spanish-speaking fans and is at the same time not retaining the Lucha Bros, but hey, who knows what the contract situation was like there, the demands and so on. But yeah, it's just I would also just be like, look, Rey Fénix is going to leave. Just let him leave, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just get it over with. But
it just sucks. You know what doesn't suck? Chris Jericho versus Matt Cardona final battle main event.
Are you sure about that?
Okay. Let me present my case because
okay.
The match in a vacuum doesn't sound like it'll be great, but these two were severely motivated for this match. They want to do it, and Jericho can still pull stuff out of his butt. Matt Cardona's done a phenomenal job of reinventing himself and making it like he's essentially like an indie version of Chris Jericho in his modern stage, where he's done a great job of making himself feel important in every single company that he's been in over the past couple of years. He's gone from just being the Long Island iced tea to like a great deathmatch wrestler and a guy who's willing to do anything for the company he's working for. I think this could be a really good match. Now, there's the caveat. It could also really suck. But I can tell you, I'm interested to see it. And where Ring of Honor is right now, how many better options were you going to find?
Yeah.
Both of these guys are motivated to work this match. And I think that is a huge factor in why I am excited about it.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see how it goes, but I'm not exactly being moved to like plug in my card info on ROHworld.com. So
yeah, I completely understand. If it pops up, I'll watch it. I'm very intrigued by it, but I don't know. Like, I also get it. Like, is it worth paying the $40 for? Probably not.
But I think it might just be streaming, like with the subscription now. I don't even think it is actual pay per view. But
it's also fair. Let's go to good news. Couple health related things. Maria Kanellis's tumor is not cancerous. I can kind of sympathize with her because we had similar issues. I was 11, and she's obviously a full grown adult. The thyroid. I had most of my thyroid removed when I was a kid. And because it had a benign tumor on it. And Kanellis had a similar thing, and she's healthy, which all the blessings to her. That's tremendous, tremendous news. And the other health-related news, Taz is recovering well from his knee replacement, which, hell yeah, love to hear that. Hopefully he comes back soon. I'm going to be honest, I miss him.
Yeah.
Other than that, Fred, that's all the news. It only took us 72 minutes.
Yeah, that's all. Got more C2 coming up. They got Okada wrestling on Rampage, which is a very interesting move. It'll be interesting to see what he means for the rating of that show. I'm kind of pessimistic on what it will mean, but maybe it'll put eyes on the product.
which is all you can hope for. I have more thoughts on like the women's division, but I'll save those for next week. So.
Yeah. So far, the C2's been good. I've enjoyed it, but I do think that there's more that they can do.
Yeah. I don't think it's up to the level of last year so far. It's very early. Maybe they'll get it together.
Yeah. Precisely. Fred, anything else?
No, I'm done here.
Me too. 5 stars, like, comment, subscribe, all the fun things. And
thanks for listening, everyone.
Thank you so much for listening. We are just worn out by CM Punk. This is his fault. You can tell him that he's why we're ending the podcast a little short today. I'm Tyler. He's Fred. Have a good one.
Take care.
Hello. Do you like New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are you a Shin Nihon freak? If so, check out the Super J-Cast with Joel and Damon on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
And even if you fucking hate New Japan Pro Wrestling, listen to the Super J-Cast anyway. Not just for our great show reviews, analysis, and pastrami sandwiches, but there's also usually some dick jokes somewhere in the obligatory opening 30 minutes of absolute nonsense we chat about every single week. That's the Super J-Cast for all the best talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, crisps, and pornography.